From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, as a Kenosha casino is debated, we look at the current state of the Menominee Tribe. A century ago today, a storm blasted through the Great Lakes and destroyed more than three dozen ships.
These boats, the ones that were found, were all upside down, indicating that it was very likely they were just bowled over. And we're not talking about small vessels here. We're talking about huge vessels.
Plus some suggestions for polishing up your resume. And artist Dirk Schraber destroys cars for the sake of art and discovers a transformation.
For me, it's all so abstract and just material, and I think in different ways about, of course, I know it's a car, but then at some point, it is not really a car anymore.
Lake Effect is next, after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for joining us today. Governor Scott Walker is still weighing whether to approve a major casino project in the Kenosha area. The Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin cleared the federal hurdles required to open the proposed Menominee Hard Rock Casino. But to move forward, the $800 million project, which would be built on the site of the former Dairyland Greyhound Park, needs the signature of Governor Walker. Walker has said he wouldn't approve it without unanimous consent from all of the state's tribes. The Forest County Potawatomi and the Ho-Chunk tribes have opposed it, saying it would siphon revenue from their existing casinos. But news reports this week suggest the governor may be softening that stance. Meanwhile, a report this week in the Business Journal of Milwaukee examines the economic conditions on the Menominee Reservation itself. David Schuyler covers the casino debate for the newspaper, and he's with us now. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you.
There's a lot of discussion about the impact of the proposed Kenosha casino on that area's economy and its potential impact on existing casinos in the state, but relatively little talk about its impact on the Menominee Tribe itself. So let's do that. Let's talk about the Menominee Tribe for a while. What is the current state of the tribe's economy?
Well, the Menominee Indian Reservation makes up Menominee County, which has by far the worst unemployment rate in the state of Wisconsin and some of the highest levels of poverty in the state. The state's most recent unemployment estimates put the jobless rate at nearly 17%. The next highest level is found in Iron County, where the rate is a little less than 10%.
And this is let's give people some perspective. Menominee County is in the North Woods, essentially.
It is a little northwest of Green Bay.
And how large a population are we talking about?
The Menominee Tribe has 8,860 members, but fewer than half live on the reservation because of the lack of jobs. Because of that, the county's population is only about 4,300. American Indians, largely Menominee, make up 85% of the population of the county.
So essentially, this is a county that is really economically challenged.
It is. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, in its annual report that ranks counties across the United States on a variety of health and social economic factors, found that it has some of the worst poverty rates and some of the worst health outcomes in the state of Wisconsin. Those factors include morbidity, mortality rates, and clinical, social, and environmental factors. For example, the foundation found that 48% of children in Menominee County live in poverty, compared with 18% statewide. 60% of children live in single-parent households in the county.
And you write about you know, crumbling infrastructure. The education system is really facing challenges as well, right?
That's true. They have one tribal school that's in a 100-year-old building on Menominee County. That's one of their priorities. And they do have an outdated health clinic as well.
Some critics of the plan to build and open this casino in Kenosha point out, you know, it's far distant from Menominee County. I mean, we're talking, about 150 miles from where most of the tribal members live, or about half, I guess. And so its direct impact on employment in that county would be minimal. How does the tribe contend a casino in Kenosha might affect a distant county with the highest unemployment rate in the state?
Well, certainly a lot of that revenue from the casino was going to be flowing into Menominee County and to the reservation in order to provide for basic social services as well as the replacement of a school, the replacement of their clinic. And the Menominee County leaders have told me that they expect the Kenosha County Casino to create 200 jobs on the reservation itself. In that way, it does help provide for jobs and lessen the impact of the poverty on the reservation.
You mentioned some of these older buildings. Can you go into more detail about what the tribal leader's priority list is for casino revenue?
Yes. One of those is the construction of a new clinic to replace their outdated clinic, construction of 100 new homes and apartment buildings to provide adequate housing for reservation residents, the construction and staffing for a juvenile corrections facility, and they want to replace their outdated school, as well as provide funding for Menominee students to help them attend college.
Now, you draw a parallel to the experience of the Oneida tribe and its work in terms of casinos. What was that experience, and why do you think that's a good comparison?
The Oneida has been in sort of the same situation. A lot of Oneida members did have to leave the reservation in order to find jobs. Ernest Stevens, who is the chairman of the National Indian Gaming Association and a member of the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin, he told me that he had to leave because there were no jobs available. He had visited every gas station and convenience store in the area only to be turned away.
And which – remind us, which casinos casino or casinos does the Oneida Tribe operate?
The Oneida Tribe has their main casino just across Highway 172 from Austin Straubel International Airport. And they also have a smaller casino, which is a fairly major gaming operation on Mason Street in Ashwaubenon.
And these have largely been a success for the tribe?
They have been. They have provided for lots of jobs for Oneida members, as well as providing money and resources for investment in other business opportunities. They own and operate two hotels, a golf club, as well as a chain of convenience stores.
Now, I'm not sure whether a lot of people are aware that the Menominee Tribe already operates gambling facilities. What can you tell us about their existing efforts in the casino industry and how they've affected the tribe's bottom line?
The Menominee Tribe does have two casinos on the reservation. Because they're on the reservation, they're largely isolated from these major population centers of Green Bay and Wausau. In fact, their customer base is limited because of Oneida's casinos in Green Bay, because gamblers don't have to leave that area. And along that Highway 29 corridor between Menominee County and Wausau, there are three other gaming operations that sort of siphon off customers coming from Wausau.
So you would kind of describe this, not to put words in your mouth, but they're at a competitive disadvantage.
Absolutely.
I spent some time on the website of at least one of their casinos and looked at a map, and you really have to want to go there to go there. This is in, I think the community is Kashina, is that right?
That's right. And it is really in an isolated area of the state. And like I said, there are other casinos in the area that are much easier to get to.
Well, and so put into perspective how this proposed Menominee Hard Rock Casino compares to any previous projects the Menominees have worked on. It's got to be far larger.
That's true. It will have about 3,100 slot machines and 75 table games. That is much bigger than anything that they have on the reservation.
As a small tribe and one that only operates a couple of very small casinos, this is something that they would contend requires the participation of a substantial company like Hard Rock to be involved in. This is not something that they're likely to be able to do on their own.
Absolutely. The Hard Rock gives them what they believe is credibility, as well as the ability to operate a casino facility of this size.
Well, and the governor is expected to announce whether he'll approve this project in the next couple of days, actually. And in the waning days of this decision, which has kind of played out for a while now, we're learning some things about the delicate nature of being a politician in southeastern Wisconsin these days. The project is getting some qualified support
Well, yes. Robin Voss, who is the Speaker of the Assembly, has voiced his support in favor of his constituents who have come out in large numbers to tell this casino is very important for Racine County, where the Menominee has pledged to hire hundreds of jobs from.
And this is a delicate balance because Robin Voss is obviously an ally of the governor's, and he's kind of walking a line here, but he's coming down in favor of his constituents, if not endorsing the proposal itself.
Yes, and he is a key Republican, and having support, and with the casino having his support, certainly bodes well for the Menominee Tribe and Hard Rock.
David Schuyler, thanks so much for adding some perspective to this story.
Well, thank you.
Dave Schuyler is digital producer for the Business Journal of Milwaukee and covers the nonprofit sector along with arts and the casino industry. There is a link to his article on the Menominee Tribe from WUWM.com/lake effect. A short break now, and when we return, we'll look back at a storm that devastated shipping on the Great Lakes 100 years ago today. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tike. You remember yesterday's weather? The steady rain, the winds that whipped up, the dropping temperatures. It was kind of nasty out. Well, forget about yesterday's weather. We're going to spend the next few minutes looking back at the weather 100 years ago this week. Michael Schumacher, how nasty was it then?
There was a great deal of snow that came with this. On land, it was unbelievable. You know, cities were being buried. The winds vary, as they do in storms, between 30 and 100 miles an hour. And it lasted for extremely a long period of time, the duration.
In fact, the storm was so bad, people considered it a freshwater hurricane. Dozens of ships, huge freighters, sunk or were stranded on the shore, and more than 250 sailors lost their lives as the storm raged across the Great Lakes. Schumacher's new book, November's Fury, looks back at that destructive storm. He joins us on the line from his home in Kenosha. Thanks again for being with us.
I've always enjoyed being on the show. This is a good one, and I appreciate the interest in the book and the chance to talk about it.
I think we can grasp what a really bad storm on the Great Lakes might be like just from our experience here, you know, high winds, heavy snow, or even heavy rainfall. But what were the waves like on the Great Lakes during this storm?
Depends on who you're talking to, but there's very little doubt the waves on the lake were between 30, 35 feet for the better portion of the duration of the storm. One captain reported a 70-foot wave, like a rogue wave and so forth. The simplest way to put it is that without a doubt, the captains on the lake swore this was by far the worst ever in the history of the lakes. What does that mean in terms of force? It's hard to imagine this, but in his book, Sebastian Junger, A Perfect Storm, talked about a wave about 10 feet high, 50 feet long, traveling at 32 miles per hour, generates 2 million pounds of pressure. Now, the waves that were on the lake at that time were much, much larger than that. Much, much longer than that. And the pressure it put on these boats, when one of these slammed into it, in some cases, it literally stripped away the entire pilot house, tore these boats up into nothing. The ones that sank on Lake Huron, which was hit the hardest, these boats, the ones that were found, were all upside down, indicating that it was very likely they would just bowled over. And we're not talking about small vessels here. We're talking about huge vessels. One vessel, the Carruthers, was so new. It was only its third time out. And this particular boat had been given every kind of reinforcement and safety feature imaginable. And it just plain disappeared. It's never been seen.
There was a precursor to today's National Weather Service that existed in those days. What was their forecast for the lakes leading up to the storm?
Well, the Weather Bureau, as it was called, which was based out of Washington, D.C., forecast storms. This is one of the things that a lot of the captains of the companies afterwards accused them of not projecting a storm. They indeed did. And they projected those storms in 113 different stations or ports around the Great Lakes. They projected gale force winds. Their biggest problem with it was predicting the wind direction. Velocity is always hard to project, but the direction, and in this particular storm, the wind changed direction just almost continuously. It was one of those things that captains that had experience out in the lakes had no way of preparing themselves for. It would be out of the northeast, then all of a sudden it was the north, then it was the northeast, then the northwest, and there was no way to hide from this storm if you were out in it. In other words, the captain will try to get in the lee of a storm to keep the boat safe from some of these mountainous waves that come up. And that wind direction was the indicator of where you should be on the lake at that point, if you can, or how you should seek shelter. Here, there was no way of knowing. A boat, and one in particular, the Sheetal, took shelter in Pie Island in the northern part of Lake Superior, and was perfectly protected until it wasn't, so to speak. It was in this little area. It dropped an anchor. It was going to wait out the storm, and it was fine until the wind shifted direction, and they found themselves in a terrible situation where the waves were coming at them from a different direction. They were building, and they had to get out of there for their own safety. So the weather was so hard for the Weather Bureau to predict that they just couldn't get it done.
And the agency wasn't necessarily believed by the shipping industry anyway. You write that the shipping industry kind of took these forecasts with a grain of salt.
You're absolutely right. They ridiculed them largely. You know, it was like, what do they know? Captains took pride in their shipping records in storms. They understood weather. There were some captains out on the lake that understood the weather probably as well as anybody that was dealing with it. But in this particular case, they got caught where their experience didn't help. In other words, it usually took a day or two for a storm to blow through the Great Lakes. In this case, it was 4 days. The storm hit the two upper Great Lakes, Superior and Michigan, and wreaked havoc on these two lakes, sinking some boats, grounding a number of other ones, and then it seemed to settle down. It seemed like nothing was going on. The captains on the lower lake thought, oh, okay, it blew itself out. And out they went, but they were wrong. A storm out of the southeast joined the storm that was causing all this other trouble in a tremendous system centered right over Lake Huron. And anybody out on Huron was doomed. One boat that was out on Lake Huron traveling up the length of the lake made it through without either being grounded or sunk or so heavily damaged they had to turn back.
So then it sounds like if there was any one single most common error made by ship captains in this case, it was in leaving port at all.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And it should be noted that the enormous percentage of ships, majority of ships, stayed in. Some captains, they like to call themselves the heavy weather captains. They got big, powerful boats that they feel all the confidence in the world in, and they have no issue traveling in storms, and which is what brought down a number of the boats in that particular storm. And another anniversary that we have coming up, the Edmund Fitzgerald. Same thing. It was one of the biggest, toughest, most modern boats in the business, and it just got beaten, you know, to death, literally, by this storm. Captains have faith in their boats when perhaps they shouldn't. And also the communications. When you talked about the Weather Bureau before, There was ship-to-ship and ship-to-shore communication that were available in those days, but nobody wanted them. The owners of the boats didn't want to invest the money. The captains and their crews didn't like the idea of having a situation where the shipping company could be kind of watching their movements, and you know they were being spied on, essentially. So why is this important? There was one fleet, the Shenango fleet, that had a bunch of boats that were all state-of-the-art, the best safety features you can imagine, plus all were equipped with this communications equipment. Not a single one went out. Not a single one was damaged. I think that's significant.
It's also interesting. I mean, you write about this confluence of factors that did in these ships, the high winds, the enormous waves, anchors that wouldn't catch. But there were also not really a lot of people in a position to rescue ships in trouble either, were there?
No. No. And there's one picture in the book of the Port Embark life-saving station. And, you know, you see it before the storm. And then you see it after the storm, and it's been reduced to rubble. The weather was so intense that the life-saving efforts were doomed. They couldn't get out there on the water to even help these people.
Well, and in the end, what was the tally of people killed and boats lost?
They're not certain of a number. And the reason for that is that they didn't keep good records, crew lists back then. They have them. They know that more than 250 men died in this storm, which is by far the largest tally for a single storm in history. There have been greater losses when a big boat would go down, and you know, in some cases, hundreds of people would die if you know a passenger ship is the one that went down in the Chicago River was. But in terms of a storm, there had never been this kind of devastation, loss of human life and property, before or since.
And it was something like two dozen ships sunk or grounded, right?
Yeah, it was actually more than that even. It was probably close, and again, I don't know the exact figure, but I want to say in the neighborhood of 38 boats either sank or were heavily damaged, grounded. Maybe the most amazing statistic to me was 8 boats. Now, we're talking about big ones, you know. 8 boats went down in like a 5-hour period on Lake Huron. They know because when the victims were washed ashore, they saw what their watches were. And they would see, well, the Wexford sank at such and such a time and so forth, because their watches stopped. Mm. And this is really just a totally amazing statistic to me, that many in that short a period of time. It tells you just how unbelievably intense that storm was. This was down toward the bottom of Lake Huron, and there were some boats that actually survived it. I tell the story of the Sheetal, which is a boat that just the captain decided that his best chance was to stay out in the storm rather than to try to find safe harbor and turn it into an exercise of rolling the ship. And he nevertheless took his chances of being hit broadside by the waves, and he did. He got beat up very badly. But he managed to last out the storm just sailing in it. Another story about this 18-year-old wheelsman, third wheelsman, on board this ship. His captain is they're running out of lake, you know. They're down at the bottom of Lake Huron, and they're being blown south. And the captain was kind of indecisive about what to do. And the kid just took the matters into his own hands, made a wild turn with the boat, and ran it right up on shore and saved everybody on board the ship. It was heroic. I think it's also significant that not a single soul in a shipwreck, in a boat that was lost, not a single soul survived. It was lost with all hands in every single instance. The number of people got on lifeboats and so forth, none of them made it. In fact, some lifeboats were found where the people, you know, the sailors, had literally tied themselves into the boats. They've tried everything to stay afloat in this. They did, but they died of hypothermia. So it was devastating.
and just a truly remarkable set of stories you tell in this. Michael Schumacher, thank you so much for flashing us back 100 years to this really amazing and devastating time in Great Lakes history.
It was really my pleasure. As you can see, once you get started, you can talk and talk about it because there were so many different boats. And I tried to get as many stories and human stories as possible.
Well, you really bring it alive, I have to say.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Michael Schumacher's new book is called November's Fury, The Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913, published by the University of Minnesota Press. He joined us by phone from Kenosha. Some suggestions for polishing up your resume from one of the state's only certified master resume writers when we return with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. When was the last time you updated your resume? Even if you're not actively seeking a job at this moment, experts say it's good to keep it current. So not long ago, we turned to Madison-based certified master resume writer Brenda Bernstein, who's also the author of the new book, How to Write a Winning Resume, 50 Tips to Reach Your Job Search Target. She shared those tips with Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce, including targeting your resume for a specific job.
Every job does require something different. And the trick in writing a resume that's going to be a winning resume is to look at the job description, look at the keywords that are in the job description, put them into your resume, and not just put them there in a list, but substantiate your ability to meet those skills and show your results from the activities that you performed. You always want to be showing results. Numbers and results and accomplishments are what are going to get you the job, because if you just write that you had these particular duties, even if you hit all the keywords, it's not going to get you very far, because there's going to be someone sitting next to you who had all the same job duties, but you know, you increased sales by 80% and they increased sales by 60%, so which one of you is going to get the job?
Well, so where do you start? How do you recommend people begin to create their resume?
This is actually one of the chapters in my book, What Do You Do to Start Getting Prepared to Write Your Resume? And one of the things that you need to be really clear about is what your accomplishments have been in all of your past jobs. So you're going to want to look at what you did in your previous job and go through and look for, okay, how did I make a difference in that organization? Did I increase sales there? Did I improve processes there? What makes you unique? What is it that you want to convey through your resume that's going to make you shine as someone with a unique personality, unique accomplishment? If you can actually show yourself, even something about your personality through a turn of phrase or something in your resume, then you're doing a lot more than most people who are submitting their resumes. So really think about it. You know, who are you in the workplace? What have people complimented you on? And how can you transmit that information through your resume?
Now, for some people, that might be quite a few things. How do you prevent information overload on your resume?
That's a good question. If you think you have too many things, there are several strategies that you can use. One of them is to organize the information creatively. One way to do that is to put categories. So let's say here are three examples of how I shrank costs at my organization, 1, 2, 3. And then here are three examples of how I did revenue generation at my organization, and say 1, 2, 3. And here are three examples of how I thrived with customer relations, and then put those 1, 2, 3. So then it doesn't feel for the reader like it's just, instead of having just 9 bullets, all in a row and they're indistinguishable, you can divide them into these categories. It makes it a lot easier for the reader to absorb it.
Are employers looking for different key points on a resume today than they have in the past?
I would just say that they are much more focused on wanting to see numbers, wanting to see metrics, wanting to see what results did you produce. In the past, it was sufficient to write your job duties. And that's just not going to fly anymore because everyone has the same job duties. They're all applying for the same position, and it just doesn't matter at this point. Now, you might need to have those words because you want to have the right keywords in your resume. But if you have a keyword, you want to not just have the keyword, but have how you use that keyword to make a difference. What's the result you got? It's always, what's the result you got? What's the result you got? I think that's a big change over, let's say, 5 years ago, where there were more resumes that were actually succeeding in getting jobs through speaking more generally about the job duties and responsibilities. I take the word responsibilities off my resumes. It just, in my opinion, doesn't belong on a resume.
Well, what are some keywords you should definitely leave off your resume or other do not do's that you suggest to your clients?
Some other words that I find commonly on resumes are the words helped and assisted. Those are tricky words for a resume. Now, if you're a nurse and you assisted a patient, then you probably need to use that word. But if you assisted the director to organize a conference, that doesn't tell us much. We want to know exactly what you did. You don't want to say that you helped do things and assisted in doing things, because that leaves you it leaves the reader not knowing what you did. So be specific. Come up with a verb that's more about what you actually did have responsibility for instead of that you helped someone else do something. The other word, this is my personal pet peeve, is the word various or variety. I don't see the reason for it. And if you have various or variety on your resume, look at whether you can take it out and get a more powerful phrase without it. So you might say, oh, well, performed legal research and wrote memoranda and briefs on various civil, procedural, and substantive issues. Various is in there. So if you take it out, then you actually forced to describe what those procedural and substantive issues are, so you might be left with performed legal research and wrote memoranda and briefs on civil, procedural, and substantive issues, including unconscionability, issue preclusion, and equitable estoppel. And you can hear the difference in the power of that bullet.
What would you say is the big tip that you have in how to write a winning resume that every resume writer should know?
Well, there are two. Number one, target your resume. Another top recommendation, of course, is to write about your accomplishments instead of your responsibilities. And I'd say a third thing is to use an appropriate format. Do some research on your industry, what formats are acceptable in that industry. If you're in insurance or finance, you're not going to have a very fancy format. If you're in sales or marketing, then you might. And then you need also to have a resume. And just today, I got a new client who showed me her resume, and she's frustrated that she's not getting calls from any employers. And when I looked at her resume, what I saw is that if this resume were submitted through a computer system, the computer wouldn't be able to read it. How to format a resume so that the information you put in it will actually be read by the computers is extremely important. It was sad because this person had great accomplishments, but she just didn't have the right formatting, the right headers, and the right organization of her resume that probably anyone would ever see it. Like, they'd probably get just a blank submission on the other end because of the way it was formatted. So very, very important to format your resume correctly, to have one version for the computers, and then have your presentation resume that's beautiful and pretty for when you walk into an interview and you hand it over that desk.
Well, Brenda Bernstein, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Brenda Bernstein is Madison's only certified master resume writer, who's also known as the essay expert. Her recent book is How to Write a Winning Resume, 50 Tips to Reach Your Job Search Target. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce in September, and you can find more information from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Milwaukee is usually thought of as a beer kind of city, but increasingly, Wisconsin is being known for its wines. Lake Effect essayist Andy Feldman is a Wisconsin native who's still learning about wine thanks to a recent trip across the Atlantic.
They say Wisconsin is the Bordeaux region of craft beer. And one nice aspect about tasting and learning about beer is that it's pretty down to earth. No one stands in the beer aisle looking over the Spotted Cow or River West Stein and says, "This is intimidating." Learning about wine, on the other hand, can be intimidating, French wine in particular. This past August, though, I was lucky to spend a week in southern France for my 40th birthday. It was a memorable trip, exploring hill towns, visiting Roman ruins, and enjoying Provençal cuisine. And while I still returned from the trip a wine novice, I did gain an appreciation and had less intimidation for that famous French art form of winemaking. So if you're a novice as well, here are some fun facts to help you be less intimidated too. The first is about French wine labels. The French, unlike American winemakers, don't label their wines by the type of grapes they use. In other words, you won't find French wine labels that say Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Cabernet, and so on. Instead, they label their wines by the town or area in which they're made, such as Côte de Rhône or Bordeaux, or over 300 other appellations, as they call them. And winemakers in each town or area are required to use only certain types of grapes, regulations that winemakers themselves created for quality control. To put this in a Wisconsin context, it would be like vineyards in, say, Wauwatosa being required to use only Grenache and Syrah grapes, while vineyards in Shorewood could use only Sauvignon Blanc grapes. The French system of wine labeling makes it more challenging for a novice to know what they're buying. On the other hand, though, it's an invitation to explore different wines and see what you like. Even wines from different vineyards in the same village can taste differently because of what the French call terroir, the unique natural characteristics of each vineyard, such as soil and altitude and so on. So, having learned a bit about French wine labels, I set off for one of the most revered French wine villages called Château Neuf-du-Pape. This was a place for serious wine drinkers and buyers, not folks like me who think Miller Lite tastes great and is less filling. But as I learned in the wine museum in town, the area had a blight in the late 1800s that killed off most of its vines. It looked like wine growing in the area was history, but with some clever innovation, they found a solution. By grafting the roots of American grapevines to their local vines, the plants became blight resistant. So, fun fact number two, the delicious top-shelf French wine, Château Neuf-du-Pape, has American roots, literally. And there's a second connection between this famous French wine town and the United States that I appreciated even more. I realized it on a walking tour when I came upon a small plaque with an American flag on it near the town center. It read, "Château Neuf-du-Pape was liberated on August 20th, 1944, by soldiers of the 3rd Infantry Division during World War II. American roots in that town, it turns out, go a lot deeper than the soil. Now that I'm back from vacation, don't worry, I'm not drinking French wine while I watch the Packers game. But the trip did remind me, as traveling always does, how interesting it is to learn about different traditions and how surprisingly interconnected we all are. To that I say, cheers.
Lake Effect essayist and Milwaukee native Andy Feldman now lives and works in Washington, D.C. The contrast between catastrophe and beauty is just one element of a new exhibit opening today at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We'll get a preview when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you've walked along the lakefront by the Milwaukee Art Museum recently, you might have seen a new sculpture and done a double take. The piece features a compact car, a really compact car, as it's smashed up and wrapped around a pole. The installation is part of an exhibit opening today at the museum called Currents 36, Dirk Schraber. The exhibit features 9 paintings by the German-born Schreiber, each featuring an image that is both aesthetically beautiful and also catastrophic, from an overturned and burned-out camper to foreboding images of a scuba diver holding a weapon. It also features the American Museum debut of his 2012 video Turgidity, which depicts the destruction of a car in slow motion. Schreiber and exhibit curator Margaret Andera joined us in the studio to share more of the story. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Margaret Andera, as the curator of this exhibit, what first drew you to Dirk Schreiber's work?
Well, at the museum, we had been interested in Dirk's work for a while. We had followed his paintings, and then when he started doing the sculptures, and actually a local collector suggested that we visit his studio when we were in New York. And we went there, and Dirk showed us around, and we saw some of the paintings he was working on, and we were more and more interested as we spent time there. And then we actually got a sneak preview of his first work in video. It was on his laptop, and it was taking this concept of the car crash into a new media for him, video. And it was right then and there in the studio, I think, where we sort of looked at each other, Brady Roberts, the chief curator, and I, and said, we should really do a show of this guy's work. And that was, I think, where it all started.
Well, and could I ask you this question? You know, I'm curious about both the physical installation of the car crash and the video, Turgidity, which is part of the exhibition. As a painter, you have the ultimate control over how to present things, the material. But with the actual car and the videography, are you at the mercy of how entropy works? Do you feel as an artist, are you yielding some control to the physicality of this?
For the video, the interesting thing is when it presents in such kind of slow motion. Well, in painting, there's always this moment when you go on with your painting. The same time you develop something new, you lost another painting. So the process of painting sometimes is once the painting is finished, you have lost hundreds of paintings this painting was in before. In the video, this process is not happening because, A, it's a slow motion, so you can see exactly what is happening in a very slow movement. And on the other hand, well, it loops and it goes backwards, so sometimes it feels to me there is nothing lost. And it's one of the different approaches.
Well, and what about with the physical car, the sculpture of the car wrapped around this pole? Is it similar to painting? Do you have to know when to stop, essentially?
The question doesn't come up because it's a planned destruction of a car in a facility where they used to do this in different ways. They do this every day, and you can't stop the process. So the car will be smashed around the pole, and that's what's going to happen. And then after, you could repeat it if it went wrong or so. I'm not trapped in this position that I have to say, stop here.
Do you think, and maybe this is off base, but is there something to choosing the kind of car, the process by which it's being smashed?
Yeah, basically I was thinking about the concept that I should take a new car from the band, from the belt, which was never on the road. And so I was looking at the car just as material for a sculpture. But then, well, I had a hard time to fund this concept, so I was going for the newest cars I could get. But if you do this to cars, convertible cars are looking better somehow. They come out better when they are wrapped around a pole.
Does it expose what's inside?
Yeah, better? Exactly.
Margaret Andera, what do you think people viewing this exhibit might get from the cumulative effect of seeing all of these works together rather than, say, the single sculpture or just the video installation or an individual painting?
I think the purpose of an exhibition like this, where it shows a span of work from an artist's career, I think if you would just encounter, for instance, the sculpture, you would really be stuck with that iconography, and somebody might walk away from that sculpture thinking that's what this artist does. When you then go into the museum and see that, yes, he does paintings of car crashes too, but it has a very different feeling to it, the paintings do, and then when you see the video, I think what people will come away with is thinking that this is an artist who has taken an idea or a subject matter and taken it to places that someone like me, a non-artist, would never have imagined. And then when you see the other paintings, you know, Dirk's work is in a lot of ways, even the video and to an extent the sculpture, his work is very much about painting.
As the curator, when you see these paintings like this railroad car or the scuba diver or even something like the overturned shell of this camper, do you concoct a story in your mind?
Oh, sure. Everybody does. You can't help that. But I think one of the things that is so interesting for me in Dirk's work is the ambiguity and how you come back to the ambiguity, but you get sucked into the paintings, you get sucked into the video, and you get sucked into the sculpture. And there comes a point where the ambiguity, the subject matter doesn't even matter anymore because you're looking at shapes, you're looking at brush strokes in the painting. And in the video, there's a moment where the screen, even though you've just watched a car crash into a pole, it looks like it's this calm underwater deep sea beautiful moment, and it's very relaxing in you. So I think an artist who can leave it up to the viewer to make their own conclusions, of course that's what happens with every piece of artwork, but a lot of artists aren't necessarily comfortable with that. And I think in Dirk's work, he's not only comfortable with it, but he confronts you with that, which I think sets him apart from a lot of artists.
Do you resist the urge to walk up to someone and say, "Well, that was completely not what I intended"?
Oh no, like Woody Allen does when he is waiting in line for in front of
and Marshall
cinema.
McLuhan steps in.
No, I'm happy when somebody's drifting into it and has some connection, and that makes me totally happy.
As the curator, do you lurk and listen to what people are saying?
I do. I like to hear what everybody brings to a painting. Oftentimes I am standing there thinking, oh, I never would have thought of that. Yes, perhaps that is what that is referring to. I'll have to ask him next time I see him. But it's just interesting to hear how people can – you can be standing in front of the very same object and have such differing opinions about it. Or I think this is about one thing and somebody else thinks something completely different. And as Dirk said, he's right. I mean, when they're talking about it, it means they're engaged. And that's – as a museum presenting artwork, that's all we can ask for.
I remember scene when somebody was seeing a similar outdoor sculpture of this car, and I've heard that this person was somehow getting very emotional because there was an accident in the personal history, and I felt very kind of bad about it because it's absolutely not my intention. And then I thought, I probably should be somehow a little bit more careful, because for me it's all so abstract and just material, and I think in different ways about, of course I know it's a car, but then at some point it is not really a car anymore. It's just this object where I am around for so many years, and after just painting the first painting, it's not what it is for somebody who sees that the first time, because I'm around this terms every day, day after day, year after year. So it becomes something different.
It's interesting because there are, I think, schools that go out and bring wrecked cars from, I think, typically drunk driving accidents.
Yeah.
and place them on the lawn in front of schools as a message about drunk driving. But this is clearly not as dogmatic as that.
No, not at all. In the beginning, when I dealt with the real cars, my thinking was more about heroin figures which I was describing the immortal more. It's more a fun aspect.
The video, Turgidity, that accompanies this, it is 30 minutes long, and it captures a crash that takes place in an instant. Do you imagine that the people who spend time with this exhibition will watch the full 30 minutes?
Well, I thought about that, and I don't expect people to watch a full 30 minutes. I did it, but One of my favorite ideas is that some people might, in this dark room and with all this audio work and with a deep bass that and the slow motion they and the option that they just drift away, and with some of these images that look like you're out in space and the size of the canvas, that they probably fall asleep or they fell into a trance-like state of mind and then wake up and they're in a different part of the video. And then so that's the way I imagine it.
It's interesting you mentioned that to you it seems like outer space, because the one excerpt from the film that I have seen reminded me in some strange way of the opening to Star Trek, when the stars are flying at
yeah.
you, and it really does feel like you are the one moving.
Yeah, it looks like that. It can. I think it's because of the slow speed and all this shiny little elements that are coming towards you or drifting away from you when it goes backwards. And I heard people saying it looks like the Big Bang or so. And it's a breathing moment to me. It's a pulsing. Like it goes slowly back and forth and back and forth. So it gets destroyed and resembles together again. And I think it takes away from the destruction moment.
Do you – there are more references to your work on automotive websites than many artists probably get. Do you bristle at all as – being known as the artist who crashes cars?
Yeah, this is something I not really appreciate, but there's no way that it doesn't go like that. But I remember back in the years when I painted the railroad cars, this was one reason I stopped doing it, because I was ending up at the railroad car painter, and that's totally ridiculous.
Dirk Schraber and Margaret Andera, thank you both so much for sharing some of the story of this exhibit with us and for sharing some of the story of your work.
Sure, thank you.
You're welcome.
An exhibit of artist Dirk Schraber's work goes on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum today and runs through the beginning of March. Margaret Andera is the curator of the exhibit called Currents 36, Dirk Schraber. Today is also the museum's monthly target-free first Thursday with free admission all day. Schraber, Andera, and curator Brady Roberts will talk about the work this evening at the museum as well. You can see images from the exhibit at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Thursday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening today, as it is every day at this time. We're here every weekday morning at 10 and Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 3 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.